Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This week, as we celebrate Veterans Day, we focus on war and its impact on the course of history. We begin with a conversation with Philip Bobbitt on his new book on war and peace, The Shield of Achilles. Alan Winkler, a regular on Talking History, joins us to talk about how Americans have faced the decision of whether to go to war or not in the past. But first, Joey Skidmore takes a look at an important event that occurred this week in history.
This week in history, on November 16, 1821, trader William Becknell arrived in Santa Fe, New Mexico. He instantly reaped the rewards of good fortune by selling his goods for a handsome profit. In time, the trip also earned him the title Father of the Santa Fe Trail, a route that spans 900 miles across the Great Plains from western Missouri to Santa Fe, New Mexico. Luck and happenstance led Missouri's Native American trader to Santa Fe. Despite the Spanish prohibition of foreign visitors in their territory, Becknell and others traded with Indians in adjacent American-held territory, and during one such foray, in the autumn of 1821, Becknell met a group of Mexican soldiers who told him of Mexico's newly won independence from Spain. Becknell made with all speed to Santa Fe and became the first American to renew this country's trade with that territory. Returning the following summer with three wagon loads of goods, Becknell trailblazed his way over the Cimarron Desert, cutting through what is now the southwest edge of Kansas, to the northwest corner of Oklahoma, to Santa Fe, New Mexico, creating a shorter and easier route than the previously known mountain route. Becknell's improved Santa Fe Trail became a vital artery of American commerce.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, President George Bush recently lamented large and disturbing gaps in what children know about U.S. history and government. In recent events, our children have witnessed a great character of America, he said, yet they also need to know the great cause of America. They are seeing Americans fight for our country. They also must know why our country is worth fighting for. Well, just how much do America's youth know about U.S. history? According to the latest major study, not enough. The National Center for Education Statistics released its assessment of what the nation's 4th, 8th, and 12th graders know about American history. The report is the only nationally representative and continuing assessment of what American students know and can do in various academic subjects. The report shows that average history scores of 4th and 8th grade students have improved, but that the average scores of 12th graders have not changed significantly since the last test was administered in 1994. Moreover, more than one-third of the 4th graders, nearly 40% of the 8th grade students, and more than half of the high school seniors did not demonstrate even a basic understanding of the subject. The full report on our students' knowledge of American history can be found at the National Center for Education Statistics website, ncesed.ed.gov/nationsreportcard. In the meantime, maybe we ought to get more of our students to just listen to Talking History.
Well, I won't back down. No, I won't back down. You can stand me up at the gates of hell, but I won't back down. Gonna stand my ground, won't be turned around. And I'll keep this world from dragging me down. Gonna stand my ground, and I won't back down. Hey, baby, there ain't no easy way out. Hey, I will stand my ground, and I won't back down.
Although on Veterans Day we honor those who have fought in the nation's wars, we commonly think of war as a bad thing, the result of failures of human interaction or even of flaws in the human character. Nevertheless, war has been a constant in the course of history, and that's the subject of Eileen Dugan's conversation this week with Philip Bobbitt.
We tend to be ambivalent about the subject of war. On the one hand, we declare that war is hell and hope for the oft-promised war to end all wars. On the other hand, we hail war as an ultimate test of human courage, and we flock to the neighborhood cineplex to see the latest big-budget war epic. But what often gets overlooked are the simplest of questions. What is war, really? Is it simply a matter of states fighting over land or trying to oust a tyrant? Does war serve a purpose? And despite the treaties that end wars, why do new wars always break out? Well, with us today is Dr. Philip Bobbitt, professor of constitutional law at the University of Texas. Professor Bobbitt is a former senior director for strategic planning at the National Security Council and the author of the recent book, The Shield of Achilles, War, Peace, and the Course of History. Welcome, Dr. Bobbitt.
Good morning.
Your book's title, The Shield of Achilles, is really not a random choice at all. It reflects the very heart of this work. How so?
Yes, you're right. The image comes from Homer, who describes a shield created by Hephaestus, Vulcan, for the Greek warrior Achilles. Around the shield are depicted, as you would expect, scenes of battle, but also scenes of law courts, a wedding feast, harvest, and athletic competitions. And this reflects my view that war is not wholly alien to man like a disease, but rather is an integral part of society.
And how does your thesis reflect this in terms of the relationship between law, strategy, and history?
Law and strategy, which are usually separated in the curriculum or the way we think about things in government, are the inner and outer faces of a state. A state achieves its authority by getting a monopoly on violence within the state, within its borders, that's law, and by being free of external coercion by other states, that's war. My thesis is that there's a mutually affecting relationship between these two sides of the state, and that they are not only made in history, the great events of history, but that they are made of history, they're made out of history, because the way we understand the legitimate sources of a state's power determines that state's laws and its strategy. I believe that strategic innovations in warfare bring about changes in the constitutional order of states, how states are organized politically. And I also think that changes in the constitutional order inevitably presage changes in military strategy.
Now, most of us are taught that war is a bad thing, that it's the result of failure or aggression, but you seem to suggest that war is almost a necessity in the development of states. Why?
I think war has been a driver, in the principal driver in the development of states, but I don't mean to say that it's a good thing. Violence is a bad thing. But war is more than simply unorganized violence. Wars are the acts of states that were organized to make war in order to defend some particular cultural, historic, constitutional vision, a society's view of itself. And wars typically begin when a weaker party, a weaker state, makes a move to war because an aggressor has simply made life intolerable for it. Most aggressors don't want war. Saddam Hussein doesn't want war. He wants the fruits of war without violence. He's just willing to use violence to get those fruits.
One of the most interesting aspects of your book is that you talk about epical wars, and it's a rather new concept. Could you explain this?
Yes. An epical war starts for the same reasons that any war starts. Greed, fear, ideology, religion, messianic leaders, social upheaval, but at some point, the war engages the constitutional life of the state. Its very survival is a particular constitutional order. And when that happens, the war will continue to pop into flame, to reassert itself, despite peace treaties and despite sometimes long periods of hiatus, until that constitutional order is finally settled. The 30 Years' War is a perfect example. There was a Spanish cartoon that shows a man putting on his trousers and leaving his house and saying to his wife, "Darling, I'm off to join the 30 Years' War." No participant in an epical war really ever thinks of these wars as being under one concept. But historians can look back on them and see that there was a single constitutional threat that united them.
And you discuss as well at great length the wars of the 20th century, which you actually call the Long War. How is this an epical war?
That's a good example. I believe that historians in the 21st century will look back on the First World War, the Bolshevik Revolution, the Spanish Civil War, the Second World War, the wars in Korea, Vietnam, and the Cold War, as being about one single constitutional question. What form of the nation-state, communist, fascist, or parliamentary, would succeed to the legitimacy that the imperial state-nations had in the 19th century? And until that question was solved, not simply by violence, but solved in the hearts of the great powers that fought those wars, the war would keep popping into violence, despite peace treaties, despite changes in the Allies, despite even periods of relative peace.
How do we know that the long war is over?
We know it because the peoples of fascist and communist states have rejected those alternatives and adopted parliamentary models, not simply because they were forced on them, but because they had no interest in those options anymore. I think the people who died in the death camps in Europe did as much as anything to discredit fascism and make it odious and sickening to us now. And there really are no fascists. The fascists now are a few misfits and a few dormitory rooms. It's, Nazism is dead as an idea. And I think the people of Russia and the various republics in the Soviet Union came to believe that communism was their enemy, that the state had turned on them and was steadily impoverishing them and limiting them in the cruelest ways. So that communism now is a negligible force in Russia.
You've mentioned already the role of strategic innovation in war and peace. How so?
Strategic innovation brings with it a change in the constitutional order if it is profound, and also a change in the constitutional order can bring with it strategic innovations. I'll give you an example of each. When Charles VIII came into Italy in 1494 with mobile artillery, a strategic innovation, he rendered at a single stroke the high walls and the moats that protected the rich, weak cities of Italy irrelevant. That meant these cities had to go out and raise a lot of money fast to build new fortifications, to hire new mercenaries. And that required them, in turn, to develop a consistent source of finance, new bureaucracies, both for diplomacy, for the management of war, and the raising of taxes. These bureaucracies were the first modern states. And you can say that constitutional order proceeded directly from a strategic innovation. But to turn it the other way around, when the generals of the French Revolution took power, they could not manage the 18th century warfare they inherited because they no longer had a disciplined officer corps composed of aristocrats. Instead, they had a million passionate peasants and industrial workers who had never fired a gun, never worn a uniform, who would run if they were attacked. And so Napoleon and others developed a new set of tactics and strategies for huge pitched battles in place of the very limited engagements of the 18th century. And in that case, the change in the constitutional order brought about a change in an innovation in strategy.
What is the most recent strategic innovation?
I'd say the ones that won the long war, the development of weapons of mass destruction and the long-range delivery systems that carry them, the development of an international system of communications, and the development of rapid computation. These were all 20th century innovations that were decisive in ending the long war, and I think they will lead to developments that will ultimately weaken the nation-state.
You also talk about not only war, but peace and peace treaties. And how is it that peace treaties at the end of one war can, as you say, carry the seeds of the next?
Peace treaties, like constitutions generally, support some values at the expense of others. The compromises made are required to achieve consensus, but they become a source of conflict. The Congress of Vienna that ended the Napoleonic Wars exalted the nationalism of empires, just as Napoleon himself had. By doing that, they lit small flame of nationalism in all the colonial empires of those great states. Nationalism that eventually revolted and ended that system. The peace treaty at Versailles recognized national cultures and the idea that each national people should have its state. But that embedded in that idea is a problem. When does a national people get a state if they're a minority within another state? And if they get a state, what about the fewer people stranded within them? Down that road lies Sarajevo and Bosnia, but also Palestine and Kashmir and many conflicts around the world trace themselves back to the idea of national self-determination embodied in the peace treaty at Versailles.
The latter part of your book deals with the concept of the market state. Yes. And can you explain what that is?
Yes. A market state covenants to maximize the opportunity of the society it serves and accomplishes this by reducing reliance on law and regulation, which is so characteristic of the nation state, and instead uses market institutions and incentives to conduct many government operations and is more sensitive to the requirements of international capital markets and business networks. I'll give you one example. In the market state, poverty is to be alleviated by providing the poor with education sufficient to permit them to participate fully in the labor market, rather than by giving them generous welfare payments. Armies are raised from volunteers from the market, rather than the basis of conscription.
And what do you think would be the benefits of such an organization of a market state? What do you think would be some of the drawbacks?
Benefits are that it's better at creating total wealth. It makes a society richer. And the societies of the developed world, because they are aging so rapidly, are going to find it difficult to maintain their present system of generous education and welfare and medical care without some growth in overall wealth. Market states are also better at ignoring groups, which if you're from a disfavored group can be a very positive thing. Market states are international and partly private by nature, and we are moving into an era of a global market in which many political and military assets are held in the private sector. The problem is that the market state, like markets generally, is not very good at producing public goods. It is indifferent to community values. And so if we move into this period, which we're just beginning now, we're going to have to learn to cultivate in ourselves and in these states values of loyalty, reverence for self-sacrifice, civility, respect for family life, regard for privacy, admiration for political competence, all things that the market is inclined to ignore or even to denigrate.
How do the attacks of 9/11 and America's current war on terrorism relate to your thesis?
For the five centuries I write about in The Shield of Achilles, it has taken a state to destroy another state. Now, when I say state, I don't mean states like Texas and Nebraska. I mean states like the United States or Germany or Russia. Only states could muster armies, could organize them, could equip them to threaten the existence of some other state. That's no longer true. As we move into the 21st century, it will become more and more possible for small groups operating with weapons of mass destruction, using the benefits of international communications and computers, to deal some pretty horrific blows against states. In the attacks of 9/11, while hardly a lethal blow to the United States, were, I'm afraid, a harbinger of that future.
And do you see al-Qaeda as a sort of state itself?
It is a kind of virtual state. I mean, it has a consistent source of finance. It has an intelligence cadre. It has a global network of alliances. It declares wars. It runs a rudimentary welfare program for the families of its fighters. It has a standing army. It has a political hierarchy. The one thing it doesn't have is a particular location, but that, in many ways, makes it all the more dangerous. because it's hard to deter a state against whom you cannot retaliate.
In conclusion, I understand you have a poem that you would like to read that fits in with this theme. Could you read that for us, please?
Thank you. It's a poem called A History Lesson by the Central European poet Miroslav Holub. It takes place in a classroom. Kings, like golden gleams made with a mirror on the wall. A non-alcoholic pope. Knights without arms, arms without knights. The dead, like so many strained noodles, a pound of those fallen in battle, 2 ounces of those who were executed. Several heads, like so many potatoes shaken into a cap. Geniuses conceived by the mating of dates are soaked up by the ceiling into infinity to the sound of tinny thunder, the rumble of bellies, shouts of hurrah. Empires rise and fall at the wave of a pointer. Blood is blotted out. And only one small boy, who is not paying the least attention, will ask between two victorious wars, "And did it hurt in those days, too?"
Thank you very much, Dr. Bobbitt.
Thank you.
We have been talking with Professor Philip Bobbitt, Professor of Constitutional Law at the University of Texas, and author of The Shield of Achilles, War, Peace, and the Course of History.
Darkness at the break of noon, shadows, even a silver spoon, the handmade blade, the child's balloon, eclipses both the sun and moon. To understand, you know too soon, there's no sense in trying. Pointed threats they bluff with scorn. Suicide remarks are torn from the fool's gold mouthpiece. The hollow horn plays wasted words, proves to warn that he not busy being born is busy dying. Temptation's page flies out the door. You follow, find yourself at war. Watch waterfalls of pity roar. You feel the moan, but unlike before, you discover that you just be one more person crying. So don't fear if you hear a foreign sound to your ear. It's all right, Ma, I'm only sighing. Some worn victory, some downfall. Private reasons, great or small, can be seen in the eyes of those that call to make all that should be killed to crawl, while others say don't hate nothing at all except hatred.
As part of our marking of Veterans Day, we've invited Alan Winkler to join us once again, this time to address another aspect of the history of war, how Americans have faced the decision of making war in the past. Winkler is Distinguished Professor of History at Miami University in Ohio. He's also the author of several books, including The Politics of Propaganda, The Office of War Information, 1942 to 1945, Homefront USA, America During World War II, and The Cold War, A History in Documents.
The United States may well go to war with Iraq. Just recently, Vice President Dick Cheney urged a preemptive strike in the most forceful terms yet, arguing that swift action was necessary to preclude Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein from attacking first, possibly with weapons of mass destruction. Meanwhile, President George Bush himself has been urging support for such a war, despite a mounting groundswell of opposition. Americans have often debated whether or not to go to war. In 1898, with word of Spanish atrocities in the colony of Cuba, the United States debated whether or not to become involved. At first, business interests shied away from entrance into a conflict, fearing that it would disrupt a fragile economy. President William McKinley was doubtful as well about entering into a foreign struggle, leading the ever-aggressive Assistant Secretary of War Theodore Roosevelt to claim that McKinley had the backbone of a chocolate eclair. But then business interests became more receptive, McKinley himself accepted involvement, and the nation entered the war. President Woodrow Wilson agonized over whether or not to enter the Great War that began in 1914. He asked Americans to remain neutral, protested unrestricted submarine warfare, and sought above all to avoid pushing conflicts with powers already at war to the breaking point, even after the Germans sank the Lusitania, killing 128 Americans. Finally, however, Wilson could resist no longer, yet in his speech asking for a declaration of war, he acknowledged, "It is a fearful thing to lead this great peaceful people into war, civilization itself seeming to be in the balance." In World War II, President Franklin Roosevelt understood that the United States was going to have to enter the conflict despite a firm commitment to neutrality. American interests were clearly consonant with those of the nations trying to stop Hitler and Mussolini. Yet in the 1930s, the United States had passed a series of neutrality laws aimed at ensuring that the nation would never again get drawn into a struggle, as in World War I. Gently, FDR tried to cajole the American public, talking in 1937 about the need to quarantine aggressors in a speech in Chicago, then backing off what seemed like a call for war. As the United States sought to circumscribe Japanese aggression in Asia, Roosevelt knew that war was imminent even as diplomats attempted to head off a conflict. The Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7, 1941, ended all debate, of course, and drew the United States into the war. Americans never had a chance to debate the Korean War. After the North Koreans crossed the 38th parallel into South Korea, President Harry Truman called for a quick and vigorous response, and Americans did as he asked, even if they never really understood how the war was unfolding or what it was all about. Nor did Americans debate involvement in the war in Vietnam. We now know, on the basis of Lyndon Johnson's tapes, that the president knew the war was unwinnable, even as he demanded more and more American troops and refused to back down. But it might have been better to have had such a debate before entrance into the conflict, for when resistance began to grow in America, it tore the country apart. The current call for war is puzzling. The president seems to be using the horrifying terrorist attacks of September 11th to move a comprehensive and troubling agenda along. The administration has sacrificed civil liberties in its effort to crack down, even when repressive measures don't seem necessary. It has lashed out against an axis of evil without ever really demonstrating the link to the terrorist al-Qaeda organization responsible for the attacks. And it's demanded unity behind what often appears to be a politically motivated campaign. Wars are not easily stopped once they start. We would be wise to do all we can to avoid plunging into an ill-conceived campaign that could do more harm than good, and lead to even further destabilization of the entire world.
You've been listening to Alan Winkler, Distinguished Professor of History at Miami University in Ohio, and this is Talking History. And that's it for another week of Talking History. We invite you to send us your comments either by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or to Talking History, care of the Department of History, University of Missouri, Kansas City, Kansas City, Missouri, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Information is available at oah.org. Until next time, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.